Dark Wreath Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 7. Lecture 3, delivered on August 25, 2009. The title of this lecture is Financial Markets.
Today, financial markets. In this lecture, I am going to go through a body of terminology with you and outline in a very broad way the financial markets and the securities that are popular in the financial market. Some of these you have heard of, some of them you probably haven't heard of, but even the ones you've heard of, I'm going to be more technical, a little more technical in the definitions. Now, this is where we are talking more about finance in that investments part, although it does, of course, obviously cross into the capital markets, which is what this lecture is really about, and it crosses into financial management quite a bit, too. But there's a lot of investments kind of terminology showing up here, too. And there will be a couple places here where I will augment or slightly correct what you read in the text. Okay, here we go. Start with just a basic idea that the book brings up, and I'm going to make a little modification of it, but the book's basic idea is correct and accurate and useful. Economic units. And in this thing, I'm not talking about units in a mathematical sense. I'm talking about units in an individual identifiable sense. You would be an economic unit. The company that you go to work for will be an economic unit. Your household, someday you will be a family. Okay, someday you might be a family man. You would be an economic unit. You might work for the government. That would be an economic unit. And economic units come in two flavors with respect to their configuration with capital markets. There are surplus economic units, and there are deficit economic units. Now, these terms do not carry any valence to them. In other words, I'm not talking about, the deficit units are evil and the surplus units are good. No. This is just, and it's even more complicated than that. Look, a surplus economic unit is a unit that has cash inflow that exceeds cash outflow. Cash inflow exceeds cash outflow. A deficit unit is an economic unit where the cash inflow outflow exceeds the cash inflow. So, well, that's all well and good, but really, these you can be both at the same time. At a given point, you might have a considerable amount of money that is going to be coming in over the next 5 years. But right now, you need a burger, and you have no money. You got none. So which are you? Are you a surplus unit, or are you a deficit unit? Well, with respect to your food, you're a deficit unit. You need your cash inflow is not sufficient for an immediate cash outflow. But down the road, I mean, you've got plenty of money in the bank that will be coming to you. So over a longer period of time, we are fairly certain that you would be an economic surplus unit. And you would certainly be valued in terms of the net, so your value would be positive at any given point in time. You someday will want to own a nice mobile home, a double wide, indeed.
With a skirt, right?
Don't push it, man. You know, really, you're not there yet. So the thing of it is that you don't have the money. You don't have. Well, these, you know, for a really good one, we're talking $20,000. You don't have that kind of money right now. But you will, over your life, make a lot more than that, a huge amount more than that. So you're a deficit, economic deficit unit with respect to that purchase, but overall, surplus unit. Now, you look like the kind of gentleman who just blows your paycheck. I mean, you just waste that thing, smoke it within 24 hours.
So.
So, I mean, today, you're ready to rock, uh-huh. Yeah, you're going to buy ramen noodles by the box load. Yes, indeed. But come next week, I got no money, man. So, in a sense, right now, you're a surplus unit, but over your life, I mean, you've got epic fail. I'm not saying you do. Obviously, you're a bright, upstanding young Christian stud. You're going to make a lot of money. But you see what I mean. There are people who have large amounts of money now, but they won't have money down the road. And so, in a sense, what I'm trying to do is make this clear that it is not clear. Surplus and deficit is with respect to what we're talking about in terms of the purchase, where we are in respect to talking about time frame of the analysis, and all of that. But look, at any given point in time, we can identify what would constitute surplus economic units and deficit economic units. And the idea of finance, especially with respect to capital markets, is that we are rational, greedy SOBs. We will figure out a way to make a buck off matching the deficits with the surpluses. You don't make a whole lot of money. You make lots of money. As a financial intermediary, I must marry you two. I must make a match between you two, okay? That's what financial intermediaries do. That's the whole world of financial intermediaries, is matching those who have too much money with those who don't have enough for what they need. And also making sure that the matches are appropriate. In terms of surplus units, they will want to make money off their surplus money, their surplus dollars. So we want to match them up with deficit economic units. So the deficit economic units will pay an interest rate for having that money. However, it's not quite as easy as that, because we also have to make sure that the timings match. The surplus units are going to provide money in a way that is appropriate for what the deficit unit wants it for. We also have to, much more importantly, keep in mind risk. Because it might very well be that you need $20,000. I've got $20,000. So what's the problem? The problem is I don't trust you, man, to pay it back. You are risky. So I've got to find someone else who is willing to take that level of risk, who has a tolerance for that level of risk. I don't. So that's one of the main things that financial intermediaries do, is not only provide the money, put the matches together, but make sure that the matches are appropriate. You might need to borrow money for 20 years. I've got money, but I want to get my money back in a year. We aren't going to match. We have to find the marriages that work. And the financial intermediaries do that. The financial intermediaries bring the money from the surplus units to the deficit units. Now, in the textbook, they focus on one kind of financial intermediary. They talk about investment bankers. But let us be clear, financial intermediaries come in all kinds of flavors. Banks, credit unions, savings and loans are financial intermediaries, but they would definitely not prefer to be called investment bankers, for one thing, because then they'd face a whole set of regulations they don't want to face. A bank will provide you with a loan for a car, for a house. So too would a credit union, and savings and loans would provide these kinds of services too. They are financial intermediaries, but they are not investment bankers. They don't primarily focus on businesses. And also, there are banks that provide financial intermediary services for businesses, but they sure wouldn't want to call themselves investment bankers at all. Many banks, even banks that you would work with for your checking accounts and things like that, they provide money like working capital management money. A lot of companies, I don't know if you've already been told this, but a lot of companies, at least historically, their big money came in during the Christmas season. And there's just this lump of maybe about 3 months when that's when most of the money this company makes comes in. The rest of the year, they eat dust. So there are, banks are willing to provide these companies with cash during the lean months, and then the companies pay it off during the fat months. That way it levels out the cash flow of the business. This is a financial intermediary service provided by banks that you might deal with, but it's certainly not, I would not want to call that investment banking at all. Lots of financial intermediaries are not the kind that deal in the heavy industrial strength, stocks, bonds, bankers' acceptances, letters of credit, and all of that kind of stuff. In fact, even some that deal in some of the instruments that are mentioned in the textbook, they don't deal in the big, heavy 800-pound gorillas like CDs. A lot of banks, there are small banks, community banks, banks like that that provide CDs, but they certainly do not provide the negotiable CDs that I think the textbook is talking about. But let that aside, we'll focus on the investment bankers here, but do understand financial intermediaries come in all kinds of flavors. And as a matter of fact, even, trying to think. You might even be sometime in your life a financial intermediary. Maybe. I don't know. If you ever stuck your neck out to get a loan for someone else who needed some money, you're a financial intermediary right there. If you borrowed money to provide for someone else who needed money, that's a financial intermediary. You did it right there. Okay. And there are some cases where entities, units, provide their own financial intermediary services. Sometimes. A few times. That can happen. Okay. Now I'm going to take this off the board here. And I'm going to sort of switch gears here and give you some terminology. And you might have you've heard these terms before, but I'm going to tighten up, turn the screws on these terms to make sure that they are known in their technical sense. And it's still fine in normal conversation to use these terms in a much looser way. And you'll hear me sometimes intermingle these terms. I don't do it deliberately, but it's just common language. As a matter of fact, there's one place funny in the book where the authors describe this, the broker, and then they say a broker, they describe a broker as a type of agent. In fact, they're exactly opposite. Look, here's the three animals. There are brokers. There are agents, and there are dealers. Technically, a broker represents a buyer. A broker represents a buyer. An agent represents a seller. An agent represents a seller. A dealer represents himself or herself. A broker represents a buyer, an agent represents a seller, a dealer represents himself. So, madam, now let me pick on you. You decide you're going to buy your first really nice house, and you're driving around the fancy neighborhoods here in town, and you see, there's a house for sale. It's offered by Acme Real Estate. And you say, okay, I'm going to call Acme Real Estate. And you hear, Acme Real Estate Agency, may I help you? Well, yes, I saw this house. It looked really nice. Okay, well, let's get this thing going. We'll have you have a look at the house, and we'll work on the price and all of that. Remember, we're working for you at Acme Real Estate Agency. Talk to me. You're shaking your head. What? Acme Real Estate Agency.
So they say they're representing us, but they're really representing the person selling us?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It's a real estate agent. A real estate agent represents the seller. An agent represents the seller. So that, and it, by law, in any given transaction, there cannot be broker and agent in the same entity. You can't do that. So this agency might provide brokerage services, but in this case, there is no doubt about it. That is an agent, and real estate agency would be representing the seller. If you want representation of your own, you need to get yourself a real estate broker. Acme might very well even provide that service, but not for you, because you contacted them in their agency capacity. Okay, you follow that one. Let's try another one here. Someday, you're going to make huge money. I just know it. I mean, look at this guy. I mean, you're going to marry some older woman. I mean, you look like cougar bait. I mean, really. Sorry, dude. But, you know, you're going to have tons of money. Well, you're going to see some great stock investments. So you're going to call your broker. Hi, I would like to buy 1,000 shares of Ace stock. You called your broker to have him buy some Ace stock. Talk to me. Is that correct? Is he representing you or is he representing someone else?
He represents me.
Bingo. Bingo. He's a broker. He represents the buyer. You're the buyer. He's a broker. Yes. He represents you. You've been thinking about getting a, let's see, for you, a 1977 Ford Pinto. Those were the ones when you hit them from behind, they exploded like a ball of fire. That was so sweet. I mean, you get a big old car, you sneak out behind those suckers, boom, wee-haw! You have to back off real quick because they were running out of the car fussing and bitching about how I'm being on fire. But, you know, look. Okay, you go to Al's car dealership. I'm Al. Don't you dare call me Al. And I smack you on the back. Yep, I'm here for you. I'm a car dealer, and I'm going to get you the car of your dreams. Yes, indeed. Talk to me.
He just wants to sell it to me. He's going to end up making money for himself.
That's right. He's dealing for himself. He's a dealer. He's a car dealer. He buys inventory and sells it for himself. He doesn't represent anyone but himself. He doesn't represent you. He doesn't represent any seller of the car. The seller has already gotten rid of the car. He doesn't even represent Jesus himself. He represents himself. Follow? Okay, I want to tighten this up because sometimes in your business transactions, you might see something called an agent or a broker or a dealer. This means you would know exactly who is that person is representing, who that group is or agency or company or whatever it is representing. There are some times when an entity calls itself an agency, but it actually is a broker. Just know what's going on behind the scenes. First flag, if it calls itself an agency, I would assume that they're representing a seller. That would just be my first flag. But they might actually be a broker, or they might have a brokerage arm. Now, here's an interesting one. This is something I'll just kind of share with you since I am in the Faculty of Finance, Insurance, and Law. So let me address insurance. Madam, do you have insurance, car insurance?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you get it through some insurance agency, right? Okay. Who is that agency representing? When they get you car insurance, who are they representing? You or someone else?
Wouldn't they really be representing themselves?
No, they didn't say they were a dealer.
They'd be representing me?
They didn't say they were a broker.
So they'd be representing...
You're looking at like, who the hell else is there? They're representing the insurance companies. Many of these actually have one that they are dedicated to, like State Barn. But others represent various and they find decent prices. They might represent AIG, Cincinnati, Zurich, State Farm, Allstate. They might be able to do that. I'm not sure if that's common anymore. But certainly if they're an agency, they are representing the seller of the insurance product to you. Interestingly enough, though, in a world way above ours, a world in which I knew people back in the day, there were insurance brokers, very large companies, huge companies, the national, transnational, multinational companies actually use insurance brokers. The brokerage houses that deal in this, we used to call them the alphabet houses because most of them were like Marsh & Mack, M&M, Alexander & Alexander, A&A, Johnson & Higgins, JH, or J&H. We called them the alphabet houses. They, essentially, there were these tiers. There was the big insurance salesman, the top dog. These cats made huge money. They were consummate, perfect suits, perfect hair all the time. They were called the producers. They would interact with these very large companies. They would essentially say, our brokerage can get you the insurance package you need for all of your operations all over the world. We'll do that for you. And the company might say, okay, we will sign a letter of intent with you. You get us a good product. So the producer has produced some kind of an intention. Then at the next level of the brokerage, the insurance broker, you would have the account executives. These were the dogs, the workers. They were smart. They were essentially underwriters. They would look at all of the operations of the company, work out the insurance program, all of its aspects, and then they would go out into the market of the big insurance companies and say, here's what we need, bid. And then those companies would go out there and bid on this, providing the insurance for this huge company. And the lowest bid would essentially win. Or it also had to do with, well, here's what we're going to provide in terms of insurance and the coverages for the rates, for a certain set of rates. And sometimes they actually had to break up. If it was a complex operation, you'd have to break it up. And there would be some markets that would be able to handle some parts of the insurance package. Then there were other markets that would have to be used for other parts of it. But the account executive put together the insurance product as a package for the producer to then take back to the company and say, we've done it for you. Here's our price. Okay? That it's a big, powerful world this was. It's a huge world. It's still out there, although it's consolidated a lot. A&A, I believe, was captured by Aon Insurance sometime back. M&M got really hit hard. I believe M&M had major operations in the World Trade Center when it was hit on 9/11 of 2001. So, I mean, that can crimp your style real big. But they're still out there, and if you get into that world, quite a world. One thing I will tell you about that world was just the consummate producers. Oftentimes, a producer would start in the ranks of the account executives and would rise, sometimes actually serving in both capacities for some time until the producer built a book of business. And sometimes account executives stayed in the account executive ranks their whole lives. That was often true with women because you very rarely saw females at the ranks of producers. It was a sexist field. The females were absolutely controlled the markets as far as account executives go. They knew where everything was, who had what insurance products, and how to play that, but they never were allowed to rise. I saw that quite dramatically in some cases. But anyway, there is an example where you think about agencies, but there's a whole world out there where it's exactly the opposite. You're never going to be able to have an insurance company represent you. An insurance broker represent you. But you might be part of a company someday that's so large that it actually has the power to go to an Alphabet House or something, one of the descendants of them, and have insurance companies bid for your business. Now, let me take you into the world of investments. Kind of jump a little bit forward here. Brokers and broker-dealers are in the world of investments and finance. You called your broker, and your broker was dedicated. You want to secure 1,000 shares of stock, and you might give a limit price or you might give a firm price. I want you to buy this stock at no more than, let's say, $100 a share. You give them a limit order. I don't buy it unless you can do that for me. Now, the price might be floating around for the day around 102.5, 103. The broker is going to try to do this for you. Might not be able to. Might just not. I'm sorry, I can't do that. But what he'll do is he'll call his people, and this is a very simplified version. He'll call his people at the floor of the exchange. I have an order for 1,000 shares, limit 100 on that. And then you'll have someone there on the floor to actually literally answer phone. At least that's the way it used to be. It's not quite that way now. But that person would get the order. He might run out there himself to get that order filled. Or he might have people out there and he would send them signals. That is a whole science in itself, the science of the hand signals that are given from the sides to the floor, from one person to another. It changes. You have to change it all the time so that your competitors don't crack your codes. It's enormous. Yes, I knew it at one time, one set, but I mean, I didn't know all the sets, and I certainly wouldn't know one thing they're doing nowadays because I don't do it anymore. But it was it was extraordinarily complex. It was a full-blown language, very much like, in some ways, like American Sign Language. Didn't have verbs so much as it just had command structures to it and numerical information being conveyed. That was a whole art in itself. These cats were just, they got to body language. It wasn't just hands, it was eyes or movements of the head. Sometimes I saw that. But it looks like chaos out there on the floor. It looks like total chaos. Any of you ever see the movie Trading Places? Yeah, Trading Places, great movie, fun movie. Gave you a kind of a fun idea of just how insane it can be out there. But it looks completely like chaos. It isn't. It is very well organized. It looks like people are screaming and yelling and having heart attacks. Yeah, they are. But they know what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing. That guy, you might see maybe a little video of the floor of the exchange, some guy screaming like this and waving his hand. He's doing that for you because he loves you. He's your guy. He represents you as a broker. So he's going to tear his ass to get that deal done. He makes his coin. Just his house makes its coin by getting the deal done and getting the commission off the sale, okay? So what his job is out there is to find someone who is selling. What did I say, 1,000 shares? Find someone who's selling 1,000 shares of that stock, of that A stock. He's got to find someone out there. He might find one person. Yeah, I got 1,000 shares. It might be that he finds one person that's got 700. I'll take your 700. What else? Anyone else got 300? Fine, someone else got 300. He puts together an order. Sometimes it's very complicated getting a full order filled. He'll do his best to get your price. He'll do it if he can. Now, those are the brokers out there. But on some exchanges, there are dealers there too. Approved by the exchange, they are there for their own coin. They maintain their own inventory of a certain set of stocks. If you want one of the certain stock, you would find the dealer who is the specialist in that stock, and you go over to him. You will find that there will be other people there yelling and screaming and farting at him too. You'll see lots of screens. He'll be looking up at screens. He'll be watching what's in his mind and what's up there. And you might have your broker screaming at him, 100. I got 102. No, 100. I got 102. You get nothing right now. And he might just step back. Fine. Let's see if you can keep that price. And he might just step back and let that dealer suck wind for a while until he says, okay, you wanted 100? Is that okay? No, I want 99 now. Well, kiss my ass. Well, I don't see anyone else wanting this stock. That's a little bit fantasized, but it's very much that way. Okay? It's a wonderful world. Back in my time, it was so insane that the brokers would, I shouldn't say a lot. There were more than a few, let's say, cats who would blow coke to get it on for the day, literally. And if they got too wired, they would start cutting the coke with sedative. The sedative of choice in my time was heroin. And that would make them hyped up, but they would be mellow as they screamed their orders. That was really the way it was. In my day, there was some physical to it. Oops, my bad, ha ha. No, it wasn't quite that bad, but they're not allowed to do that anymore at all. You have to be all cultured and civil and then scream your head off and pop your blood vessels. But it is a huge life, and it's very exciting. And if you want to get into it, more power to you. There was a movie just last year, Pursuit of Happiness, was it? Did any of you see that one? Now, those guys were not training to get out there on the floor. That was not what that was all about. What were they doing? Was that a brokerage house, or was that a dealer? Did you get a sense of what was going on there? That was actually a brokerage house. I was a broker and essentially their job was to show that they could get a bunch of clients who would trust them enough to represent them for their investments. That's big world. You make a huge amount of money if you get into the world. Don't bet on getting into that world though. A lot of people who get into the stock world, and I'll just give you this caution. This is my number of students of mine. I get probably maybe 30, 40, you end up in boiler rooms where you literally, day and night, you're just calling suckers on the phone to try to sell stock to them, because that's what you do for a living. I mean, it's just a grinder, a meat grinder. One of my students actually survived the boiler room, and he rose. Most of them just said, after a while, FTS. Fancy that scenario. But anyway, enough of that. The financial intermediaries. They can be brokers, they can be agents, but whatever they are, in the investment banking world, and here I'll focus a little bit, let me focus on stock sales, on stock, okay? Now, a company can raise money a lot of different ways. It can raise money by actually selling a product at a decent price and getting people to buy it. It can raise money through borrowing money. That would be debt instruments. They can use short-term, intermediate-term, long-term, depending upon the project that they're after, the timing of debt obligation versus the use of the funds, and all that. But we'll talk about stock here. Stock is ownership. And a company sells stock. When it sells stock, it is selling a forever commitment because theoretically a company lives forever, so its ownership lives forever. Now, most people unload their stock at some point, but we assume that the body of ownership is a permanent thing. So selling stock is like getting married, except you can't get a divorce. So think about it that way as a company. Once you sell that stock, unless you finally get enough money to buy your stock back and put it into the treasury of the company, that's a marriage that'll last forever. So we're going to talk about stock sales. An investment banking firm would interact with a company that wanted to raise money through equity, sales of equity, through sales, let's say, of common stock, which is the most common kind of equity. The investment banker, remember, though, that the company is the seller, the issuer of the security. The investment banker is there to assist to one degree or another in this sale. Now, in the world that I worked in, which in as a consultant, I worked with rainmakers, and it was not particular, it was not glamorous at all on my end because I dealt with very small companies trying to raise money. But just as actually a very close to real example, a company wanted to raise on a 504, Reg D 504, wanted to raise $500,000. So the plan was, based upon pricing, we were going thinking that, well, maybe we can sell 1 million shares at 50 cents a share. So you'd go to an investment, different investment banking firms and see if anyone was interested in working with you on a sale like this. Not many were. But, in fact, eventually you can find there's someone for everyone in this world. And the investment banking firm will say, okay, we're going to work up the paperwork. We'll do that part because we don't want to get in trouble with you having defective filings with the SEC. And that was where I came in. I worked on the filings too to lower the expenses because I worked cheap. Okay, now, there are two ways that the investment banking firm can provide the service of selling the stock. One way is that they can do an underwriting. That would be they buy the stock themselves. The investment banking firm buys the stock itself and gives the money to the company. Now, they're going to keep their fees, all kinds of painful fees, so you're not going to see $500,000. There are certain limits now that weren't there as much when I was doing it. But that is the dream come true. Wow, great. The other way is through what's called a best efforts. And a best efforts, the investment banking firm would say, we'll try to sell your stock out there. We'll try to sell your stock. No guarantees. We'll do a best efforts. Now, in either of these, we're talking about a primary market sale. Primary market means that the company gets the proceeds, or at least some of the proceeds. A primary market is where the company is issuing the security and the proceeds come to the company. That's a primary market. As opposed to a secondary market, you've bought stock 10 years ago and you want to sell it. That's a secondary market. Company doesn't see a dime of that. That's just purely private transactions between investors. So that's a secondary market. Here I'm talking about a primary market. Now, in either case, now, obviously, in the underwriting case, the idea would be for the investment banker to buy the security itself, and then it will take care of selling it. It makes its money two ways. One is, of course, it will charge fees to do the underwriting. But then, once it has that stock, okay, first of all, in the first part of this, when it was essentially working with the company, what was it? Broker, agent, or dealer? When this investment banking firm first starts working with the company on a public offering of stock, is it a broker, agent, or dealer? Who's it representing? Yes. Oh, that's very good. Give her a cookie. That's excellent. It's representing the seller. So which is it? Representing the seller would be? Bingo. Very good. Representing the seller of a security. Okay, now, if it does a firm underwriting, and that's a technical term, a firm underwriting, It buys the stock. Once it starts calling up suckers like you, I got a great stock, went IPO, think you ought to buy into it right now. What's it doing then? Yeah. It actually switched its hat right midstream. It went from being one thing to another thing, because once it has bought the stock, it's no longer real. It obviously still wants to keep the company's interest in mind. It doesn't want to tank the company's stock by dumping out on the market all at once. But it is working for its own coin now. That's its inventory. That is its inventory. Now, on the best efforts side, all bets are off. Really, I had two out of a couple of dozen best efforts underwritings, best efforts offers actually ever work. They almost always fizzle. Not that the cats didn't try, but it's just not very cool. Look, in either case, though, most likely, and this is not in the book, you will see a syndicate. A syndicate is led by one house, and it then finds other houses that will be willing to participate. Like, for example, in a best efforts that I did, the syndicate, I said this morning, I think I said four, but I'm almost sure there were five houses. There was a lead house in the state of Washington, and then it had four other houses. The lead house said, we'll try to sell, it was 50 or 60% of the securities. We'll try to sell that much. And then in the syndicate, each of them is committed to selling a certain percentage on its tab. They make money if they sell it well and they get their commission. We make on our end our coin for the amount that we sell. But syndicates work that way. Under firm underwritings, there's a syndicate. There's a lead underwriter or a group of lead underwriters who handle the purchase. And then among them, they get the stock and then they sell it on their own, from their own inventory in the syndicate. And almost any decent offering will have a syndicate. The better the syndicate, generally speaking, the more houses, the better. The more well-heeled the houses, the better. And all of that kind of stuff. But that's a term that's not in the book, and it's rather important to know that an underwriting is not going to happen with just one house. It will happen in a syndicate that will unload the stock. Okay. I've said enough about this. This part is its own world. And very much this was the part that I worked in when I did securities consulting. And not making any claims whatsoever because I was a total hack at it. Didn't know what the hell I was doing. But I just wasn't going to try to just live my life as a college teacher because I couldn't teach you as much if I just knew nothing about how the real world works. Unfortunately, the real world sometimes works with things that are not so fun, like losses out the ass and a few times gunplay and stuff like that. So let me take you on here. I'm going to divide the financial markets into the money markets and the capital markets. Loosely speaking, money markets are short-term money. Capital markets are long-term money. The obligations in a capital market are long. The projects, what the cash is need, money is needed for, is long-term. You want a match between the obligation and what you're using the money for. Capital markets are for the long haul. Money markets are short markets. Now, starting with the money market, starting with the money markets, you would have in the money market the big, most common all over the place is the Treasury bill. These short-term, 1 year or less, debt obligations the government is issuing all the time. The government sells Treasury bills, which means the government borrows short-term money. Now, those Treasury bills are all over the place out there. The banking system has just enormous amounts of them. So does our central bank, the Federal Reserve. Our Federal Reserve buys treasury bills so that they can manipulate the money supply, because they can sell treasury bills to banks, which drains liquidity from the banks. The banks don't have as much money to lend if they buy treasury bills from the Fed. Or the Fed can simply buy back treasury bills from the banks, in which case the banks would get money into their federal funds accounts, and that would put more money into the system. The funny thing is that the government, for years and years and years, since the Eisenhower administration, had run deficits of greater or lesser significance, which means that there was tons of this treasury paper being issued. Not just treasury bills, but treasury notes and treasury bonds, longer instruments. Interestingly enough, at the end of the 90s, we actually stopped running federal budget deficits. We'd been closing them through the 90s. During the Clinton administration, we started running budget surpluses, which means that the Treasury was no longer selling Treasury paper. It was rather dramatic, because essentially one of the most common instruments was the Treasury bill. And suddenly the government say, oh, well, we're not going to hold an auction this week. Well, why would we? We don't need money. Well, yeah, you do. But the government was actually still issuing treasury bills just so the Fed could stay in business. But the Fed at the time, and I've speculated on this, and it's a lot of it is speculation, the Fed was not happy at all, because essentially their wings were being clipped. Without treasury bills, the Fed couldn't go to auctions and get treasury bills to use to control the money supply. The Fed essentially lost its power over the United States economy. And the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, you could tell he didn't like this at all. That's why in the year 2001, he went before Congress and he lied. He said, oh, we've got a recession. We've got to cut taxes massively. Some of the largest tax, longest term tax cuts in history, 2001. Well, the secret was there was no recession. We had an economic flat, but we didn't actually turn down. But Alan Greenspan, Federal Reserve, oh, we got to cut taxes huge, big time, long, long term. Well, all he wanted to do was drive the government into federal deficits so that the Treasury would be back in business at doing auctions so the Fed could get Treasury paper to use for money, monetary policy. And sure enough, it worked. You can just see right away. As a matter of fact, I've got an article I'll be assigning you a little later in the semester. You can see right away, sure enough, deficits returned. Treasury started having the auctions again. Fed was there, and the Fed was back in business, gathering up this paper. Now, the T-bills are very powerful instruments because, like I said, banks and the Fed use these to, the Fed uses these in the banking system to control the money supply. Right now, the Fed Federal Reserve just buys these from the banks as fast as the banks can get them just to pour money into the economy, trying to keep the economy from collapsing, the financial system from collapsing. Okay, there's T-bills. Now, another one in the short money markets, negotiable CDs. Now, CDs, the way you think of a CD, I'm talking about huge things. I'm not talking about your grandma putting a CD, $200 for you. This is your Christmas money. You can take this out in 3 years, and good boy. I'm not talking about that kind of thing. I'm talking about monsters, these 800-pound behemoth gorilla CDs that are out there. Many of those would be in M2 or M3, if you remember that from your macro classes, the monetary aggregates. You wouldn't see these things even in M1, even though they're short and they're in the money markets. They're big ones. Here's one that most people actually don't know about this, but it's a very, very big market. It's called commercial paper. And I'm kind of curious. Have any of you heard of commercial paper before? Have you been taught about commercial paper in another course or seen it? No, I'm not getting any looks like, yeah, I know what that is. Yeah, it's kind of interesting because commercial paper, it's essentially very short IOUs issued by really big, really creditworthy corporations. Maybe 30 days... Microsoft, Bill Gates, I'm going to just use you as an example here. No offense. 30 days, Microsoft needs $10 million. Just for 30 days. It would probably issue commercial paper. A $10 million commercial paper. security to handle that. And there are investors right there. Oh, they love these things. They're very safe instruments. And it's very short lending. And it's just to tide a company over for some big thing that might be needed or a cash shortfall that they were expecting. A lot of times it's commercial paper. You'll see the company say, in 6 months, we are going to issue commercial paper. We've worked out the cash flows. We're going to need this for 30 days. And the financial markets, oh, you know all about this. You understand this. Well, we'll have to make sure that it's ready for you. In fact, investment bankers deal. There are special organizations that deal in, special firms that deal in commercial paper. They actually just buy it themselves. They might sell it for their account or something like that. And then the company gets its money and then it pays it off and the commercial paper is gone. It's just a short-term IOU. Unfortunately, interestingly enough, remember I said these are very huge, creditworthy, highly creditworthy corporations. Well, once in a while, one of them tanks. Enron, highly respectable before the day that it went belly up, it had commercial paper out there, lots of it. And that really kind of rattled the commercial paper market because you don't expect companies to go bankrupt that are issuing commercial paper. That's not the kind of companies that issue commercial paper. But there was Enron, belly up, commercial paper outstanding. Bad news, because it's just an IOU. It's not collateralized or anything. I mean, you don't ask for collateral on something from a company that's really trustworthy. But spank me, Jesus. Thank God. Last one, I have a brief story about this. They're called banker's acceptances. And I'm going to tell you about one that is extraordinarily common. Now, a banker's acceptance is essentially an instrument that guarantees payment. It's an instrument that guarantees payment. A bank issues it between a buyer and a seller so that the seller doesn't get a promise from the buyer to pay. The seller gets a promise from a bank the payment will be made. And then the bank has an agreement with the buyer to take care of, you're going to pay us, right? Oh, yeah. Well, interestingly enough, just to tell you how holes can happen in education, I had gone through MBA, all of the PhD courses, and I got out there into doing consulting work, and one of the ways that I made a little coin as a consultant was by making arrangements to sell stuff or to buy stuff in other countries, and buy something, sell it somewhere else, sell something, buy it somewhere else. And I was in the process, it might have been the first one I did was there was some medical supplies in a warehouse in Houston. I was trying to make a deal to sell them in Eastern Europe. And someone said, someone in the chain said, get the LOC. Or I think it maybe said LC. And I didn't want to look like an idiot, but I was a total idiot. Here's someone with lots of courses behind me. Yeah, I know how finance works. I know every detail. I can name you all the governors of the Federal Reserve. What the hell is an LC? I didn't know. It's a letter of credit. It is a standard instrument in international buying and selling. Essentially, when you buy something from overseas, you don't just promise, well, we'll get you the money. You have a bank provide a letter of credit. That's a banker's acceptance. In fact, there were two flavors. There was one called the standard LCs, the letters of credit. And then they were talking, then they started throwing this term standby letters of credit, SLCs, at me. And that apparently, and I never actually used one, I'll just be honest with you. My understanding was that essentially the standby letter of credit, you were going to pay the seller, directly. However, the standby letter of credit stood between the two of you to promise that if you didn't get the money to them on time, the bank would do it. Okay? So it was a little different from a normal LC as I understand it. But all of these animals were bankers' acceptances, and they are common as grass in the world of international buying and selling. Letters of credit are issued by banks all the time. Banks, just essentially, if you have a relationship with a bank, a commercial relationship, they and you do international business, and it's a bank that handles that, well, yeah, they'll take care of LLCs for you. You know, you might even have the money in the bank to pay the seller, but they say we want the LC or the SLC, standby letter of credit. So this is kind of an odd animal. I never thought was really much of anything. Turned out, I'll be darned, it's big stuff out there in the real world. Capital. The financial markets are dealing capital. In this world, there is debt. There are debt securities. And there are equity securities. Both of them can be used, either of them can be used to raise money. A company can borrow or can sell stock. Now, stock comes in two big varieties. I'm going to hit that more on Thursday. I'll just repeat this part. But the two big varieties are common stock and preferred stock. But even there are different kinds of common stock and different kinds of preferred stock. There's cumulative preferred, non-cumulative preferred. Common stock, you can see common stock in some corporations, even to this day, there are two classes, possibly, if I'm not mistaken, there are a couple of companies that have more than two classes of common stock. Some of these old family companies that got really big, there is a Class A common stock that only members of the family have. And then there's a Class B that would be the public might own. Okay? So you might see different flavors of common stock out there. Might see different flavors of preferred stock. And again, I will repeat that on Thursday. I'll get back into that. But debt. Remember what I told you in the last lecture. There are bills, there are notes, and there are bonds. Bills, notes, bonds. Bills are short-term borrowings. 1 year or less. Technically speaking, commercial paper is a bill. It would fall in the category of a bill. An intermediate-term borrowing, if a company borrowed money on some kind of a debt instrument for 7 years, it would probably, you would call that a note. If a company borrows money for 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, that would be a bond. You say, now wait a minute, 100 years? Yeah, there are governments that sell very long-term debt instruments, 100 years. Would you buy a bond that paid you back in 100 years? Can you imagine anyone who would? Well, they're out there, and they very long, 30, 50, even longer debt instruments are out there. And there are financial investors who will buy them. And the question I always throw out, and I shouldn't do this because it's hard to think about it, especially when you're just starting in finance courses. What kind of a purchaser would want a debt instrument that didn't pay off? Yeah.
Would it be for tax purposes?
There is a possibility. There is a possibility there. But remember about timing. What kind of an obligation would you want to be paid off because you wouldn't need the money for 50 years? What kind of an investor would not want something to be paid off for 50 years? How about a life insurance company? You're selling life insurance to young people. You don't want the money coming flying back in your face because actuarially, most of you... Look, okay, here's the thing. You're going to die someday. When you do, it'll hurt like hell. For most people, it does. You know, and you get all pissy about it. Yeah, I wanted to live a little longer. No, you don't. You're going to die now. Okay, but that's not going to come for a long, long time. For you guys are going to live into your 80s, into your 40s or 50s. You're going to live a very long time. So a life insurance company, when you pay the premiums, that insurance company would want to put those in investments that are not going to come back to them for a long time, because actuarially, you people will live for a long time, and then you'll start keeling over like flies, unless you're killed by the swine flu, that's possible, or unless 2012 is really true, and then, you know, all bets are off, who the hell cares? But, you see, the insurance company doesn't want that money back until you're going to die. And so there would be a matching on the investor's side. Okay, we are going to have obligations in the future. These people are going to die. When will these obligations come due? 50, 60, 70 years? Okay, so as our premiums come due, we want to put those in investments that will stay out there until actuarially, approximately, we'll be needing the money for them. Got the idea? So, but wait a minute. Didn't you say 100-year bonds? Yeah. Maybe 200? Ah, there couldn't be. Sure there could. Suppose that you're an insurer that insures against losses with extremely low frequency but staggering severity. Have you ever heard of the New Madrid Fault? Have you ever heard of that? The New Madrid Fault is a very big fault line through this part of the country. There is a big fault. The last time it did a big earthquake, it was a doozy. There were only a few European explorers in this area at the time. They reported that the Mississippi River ran backwards. That's serious. Actually, it didn't run backwards. What happened was the earthquake was so severe that it lifted the water forward, and then the water came back down, lifted water backwards, and then it backwashed back the other way. It flipped them out. They thought the Mississippi was running backwards. You ever seen the Mississippi River? It's a big-ass river. Can you imagine seeing a tidal wave? Well, shit, See, hey, Chief, do you know what that is? We don't ever see it, you know? And so it was a serious thing. But can you imagine if you're an insurer who insures, let's say, all of the natural gas pipelines that run through the heartland of America from one coast to the other? Oh, that would be a real downer the day that you had an earthquake and all those lines just cracked and everyone was baked along the fault line as the explosion started. Here's a rule. Don't smoke when you're right on the fault line. Really, it's not a good idea. Okay, so you get the idea. Very, very unlikely event. But if it ever happened, good Lord. Great story, similar. The insurance pattern, the insurance coverage on the Twin Towers. Were you aware that only one of the two towers that was knocked down on 9/11 was insured? Why would they insure only one tower? That, what are the chances of one falling? Really tiny. Two? Oops. Damn those jihadists. Anti-capitalist bastards. Yeah, I mean, do you see there was absolutely no chance? Well, it turned out there was. Well, hell. It's not funny. We've finally gotten far enough past that when I say things, you know, why do you hate America, man? You're making fun of 9/11. No, man, quit it. It's just strange things happened. Yes, and there was only one gunman in Dallas, too. Anyway, Bill Notebaugh, where the hell was it? Ah, okay, now, here's the deal. Every debt instrument, except save for one, I'll save that one for next time. But every debt instrument that I will talk about in business courses has some very regular features. One of them is the payoff. The payoff, when a loan is made, when a company issues a debt security, let's say a bond, a 30-year bond, the face value, what the company will promise to pay back is $1,000 or a multiple of $1,000. That's what will be due on the maturity date. So we have a face value. Now for this course, we will always work with the face value at its base, which is 1,000. Unfortunately, you're going to hear me screw that up because I'll also be saying 100. Interestingly enough, prices of bonds historically have been quoted in a tenth of their actual price. So if I said the bond is $98.50, that's actually $985. Don't get excited that you're getting a $1,000 promise for $98.50. You'll hear me sometimes go back to that, the one-tenth. But know that I am talking really in terms of 1,000. So in other words, if I set a price of $101.75, that's $1,017.50. But the face is 1,000. The company is promising to pay you back $1,000. You will get a check for $1,000. And when will you get that check? On the maturity date. So there will be a term to maturity. That term to maturity will determine whether it is a note or a bond. I'm going to leave bills out of this, okay? Notice how that's different from consumer debt. When you borrow on a mortgage, the face value is how much you get. Like it could be, in your case, $20,000 for your trailer. For you, you're going to move to the Yuppieville over here, Ironwood, so you'd have to be paying, you'd have a face value for your debt starting out at, let's say, $220,000. And also, interestingly enough, you notice I said, well, this company's going to pay back $1,000 on the date of maturity, at the time of maturity. Well, you're not going to pay back $20,000 or $220,000 in 20 or 30 years. You see, consumer debt, what happens is that they calculate the payments, and we're going to do this in this course. We'll figure out how it's really not hard anymore with these financial calculators. It's almost like a snap of the fingers. The payments are designed so that the interest is being paid on the outstanding amount every month, and some of the face amount is being paid. So we're amortizing the debt and servicing the servicing the debt at the same time in consumer loans. That's not how bonds work. The bond stands at its face value. The company pays interest just to cover the interest for the year. We call that interest rate the coupon rate. The coupon is stated as a percent of face. The coupon rate is a percent of face. So now, suppose I said, and this is complete nonsense, but suppose I said I've got an 8.5 IBM. IBM has issued an 8.5 IBM 39. Well, let's not do it that far out. Let's do a 29. Okay? An 8.5 IBM 29. Now, this is not exactly the right listing terminology, but it serves for the time being. What that would mean is that from now until the year 2029, from now until 2029, every year, you will get a check for $85. 85? Yes, 8.5% of $1,000. And then in the year 2029, there was a song, in the year 2525. Great song. In the year 2029, you will get one last $85 check, and you will get a check for $1,000. That's how a corporate bond works. You see how nice these are, by the way, for people, fixed income people, you can put your money into these, and then you've got a certain cash flow all the time. I should point out also that in the real world, you won't get a check for $85 every year. You would probably more likely get a check for half that amount every 6 months, or maybe a quarter of that amount quarterly. The more often you get it, the more valuable the bond is, slightly. But nevertheless, just basically speaking, all we're saying here is that from the time that you lend IBM the money. You will lend them money. And for the next 20 years, up through the year 2029, you're going to lend them $1,000. And so IBM is going to send you, the bearer of the bond, the holder of the bond, the purchaser of the bond, the lender to IBM. Those are all the same thing here. You will get $85 in the mail every year. And then on the last year in 2029, you'll get that last $85 check, and you'll get your $1,000 back. So, in terms of this instrument, now notice, logically, if 8.5% is a fair return for the risk of IBM, you should pay about $1,000 for the bond. Because you're going to get $85, that's a fair reward for risking $1,000. But suppose that investments like IBM are paying 12%. And IBM is saying, we're going to pay you only 8.5%. But you can get 12% from another company that's borrowing money that's just about the same risk as IBM. Would you pay more for IBM? Would you give IBM $1,000, more than $1,000 or less than $1,000 under those circumstances? If you could lend to another company with very similar risk pattern to IBM, and that company pays you 12% a year, which would you pay, more than $1,000 or less than $1,000? Less than $1,000? More? Why would you pay? IBM's saying, screw you, I'm going to pay you 8.5%, but someone else is going to pay you 12%. IBM says, give me $1,000. They're going to give me $1,000. I could lend them $1,000. I'd get 12% back. You'd pay them less. That's how it works. Now, on Thursday, I will complete this by showing you how to price a debt security. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.